Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Unaccustomed as I am as a historian to give lectures on military history, it stands as a great pleasure to be able to speak on this centenary of Armistice Day, now Remembrance Day, and think of the fact that already through 8 or 9 time zones around the world, that wonderful peace that was brought on that momentous day has now already been celebrated, and it will rocket around the world in celebration. Remembrance this day grows in power and influence with the years. It's not diminishing in any way. It began as an armistice day, a day of deliverance from war, and it was also a day of celebration of victory over our enemies. This is not often talked about, but if we look in our diocesan archives, we will find that on the 11th of November of 1918 at 12 o'clock noon, a special service was held in Christ Church Cathedral, thanksgiving for the capitulation of our enemies and for the victory of the Allied cause. That peace had been won on the battlefields, at sea and in the air, and at huge human cost on all sides. The bodily remains of an unknown British soldier, known only unto God, were entombed in Westminster Abbey a couple of years after that event. Now on the centenary of that first Armistice Day, we stand in silence, in sadness, in awe, in gratitude. The Great War of 1914-18, the Second World War, the Korean conflict, peacekeeping assignments, and actions in Afghanistan and elsewhere remind us that remembrance continues along a great arc of endless time. Each of us pays our respects. We wear our poppies. We count our losses. I've laid a wreath in Whitehall's cenotaph in London on behalf of the Western Front Association. My wife Marilyn and I have stood in the rain watching widows, daughters of the fallen and their female kin, form up a then unauthorized unit and march in the same parade that passes down that same cenotaph of Whitehall. And every year the line grows and the numbers increase. Last year, 4 miles of humankind passed by in remembrance, in commemoration of the fallen, those buried in foreign fields or in unmarked graves. In no way do these acts of remembrance glorify war. We have seen in 2014, fighting back the tears, 880,000 porcelain poppies filling the moat of the Tower of London, one each for each British service personnel, and admired the creativity that made that possible. Now they're candles. This was a reminder of the number of Britons who would die in the Great War. And when the final tally was made, 1,100,000 British Imperial service personnel would die in that conflict, including 66,000 Canadians, many Newfoundlanders, Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans, and many others under the Union Jack. Lord Julian Fellowes, the creator of Downton Abbey, likes to tell the story of how the world was changed irredeemably in the 1910s. That short time, 1913 to 1920, a mere 7 years, formed a bridge, quite literally, from the old world to the new. The old order was swept away and the modern world had arrived. "Ladies and gentlemen," said a man entering a great English house party, "I regret to inform you that we are at war with Germany." The war changed these people, reordered their society. The men who went to the front saw things they would rather never have seen. Social barriers disappeared in the mud of Flanders. Women, old and young, engaged in war work. Vera Brittain, whose Testament of Youth has become my most adored book, became a help to others who sought to understand what had happened and how to deal with the loss of loved ones. The historian, of course, probes the big questions. How had this terrible conflagration come to be? What were its causes? How could war be avoided in the future? Many were the questions asked, but we're left with the fact of the matter that at a murderous gunshot that occurred in Sarajevo, a whole train of events occurred that would bring Canada into war. London was ablaze with rumors of an impending clash, of course, and Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, had prepared a message to commence hostilities against Germany. The Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Sir Edward Grey, said to a friend, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." And the King's ships were at sea, and Victoria Boyce had joined the famed Royal Navy. Percy James, Victoria High School graduate of 1910, had enlisted in the same Navy. And when the war was declared, he found himself in a big cruiser, the Hawk, off the coast of Holland. His ship was torpedoed, and he died, the first Canadian sailor to die in the war. Back in Victoria, the stories of what was happening in far distant fields and on the seas was bringing home remembrance to the people at the school, the teachers, and the students of Victoria High School. And Strother Foulkes, who won a gold medal in a speaking competition in 1915, remarked that, in fact, it was like we were sailing on the Titanic and all of a sudden hit an iceberg that took us all down. By the mid-August of 1914, Victoria Boers were heading to the Western Front. Two of them, at least, were mentioned in the roll call of those lost in 1914-1918 war. And I want to bring to your attention just two stories, because they're stories of faces in the crowd, their personalities. They're people we know a lot about. They've been written about in Victoria High School history. Their names are on the Roll of Honor. Herbert Beaumont Boggs died on the 26th of February of 1915. He was a subaltern or second lieutenant. He'd gone in the first wave that had taken Victoria men to the Western Front by way of Vancouver, the train eventually to Valcartier, and then that great armada that took the first division to the Western Front. He died in Plug Street, Belgium, in a famous first action of that day, and he is memorialized in the Plug Street City Cemetery. Back home in Victoria, the Portia Society was established at the school to promote patriotism and support the cause, to keep the stories going back and forth. Nelson King, who I would also like to remember personally, and his sister Jessie are persons whose story is really quite fantastic. Nelson King had been a prize student at Victoria High School. He'd gone on to take a bachelor's degree in classics at McGill University, which was connected to Victoria College. He became Rhodes Scholar. He was a teacher at Central Junior High School. The war came, and he went overseas and entered a regiment and was serving in the Royal Horse Artillery when, on the 10th of May of 1916, he was killed in action. His sister, Jessie, also of Victoria High School and of the Royal Jubilee Hospital Nursing School, went to find his grave a couple of years later, and she found them deep in the forested area of Plug Street as well. And I found it myself a couple of years ago when searching for the graves of these people. The irony of it was that Jessie King served as a nursing sister. She was at that famous place which was bombed on the coast. It was bombed by the German Air Force in 1918. She survived that, but she died of meningitis shortly thereafter. Not least in remembrance of the war, we recall what happened to the Newfoundland Regiment, later the Royal Newfoundland Regiment, because on the 1st of July of 1916, a great day of irony, because 1 July is Canada's National Day, but for Newfoundland, it's a tremendous remembrance of a great sadness. The Battle of the Somme, which occurred that day, stands like an iron gate across the avenue of history. And then we came to the Easter Monday of 1917, the great victory. We now know it because of the great memorial and the monument. Back in Victoria, there were plans to establish an avenue of trees, and 17 were put up in April of 1917 to commemorate the fallen from Victoria High School that had already died. And then eventually, after the famed battle of Passchendaele and then Amiens and the last 100 days, the war finally came to a conclusion. And Matthew Scott, also of Victoria and Victoria High School, wrote back to his mother, "The war is over at last." And he recounts how in those last days, the armistice had brought the Canadian division right into Mons, where the war had started for the British Imperial forces. Our recognition by the Belgians in Mons was wonderful, he says. "The Canadians will be remembered by the Belgians as they are now by the French, with our everlasting love and affection. As one old Belgian gentleman said, you gallant Canadians, who never knew how to retreat, but always to advance. Germany is beaten, and we are only beginning to realize now how really badly we have beaten her. One, however, cannot but respect her in many ways for the wonderful fight she put up before finally throwing up her hands. For no matter what we say, she fought until the very last, with a determination that was surprising and often made us wonder if we ever would be able to decisively beat her. It'll be some time, Mother, before I'm able to return home, but I will see you soon." And lastly comes a second war, and a poem that was written, which I will conclude these remarks. "I said to a man who stood at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown. And he replied, go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than a light and safer than a known way." Thank you.
Please stand as you are able.